Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio and love all things tech. And this is time for a classic Tech Stuff episode. This episode originally published on June 23rd, 2014. It is titled Passing the Turing Test, something that we frequently associate with artificial intelligence and actual, you know, like machines thinking, or at least appearing to think. So let's listen in to this classic episode. The Turing Test is named after Alan Turing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done a full episode on Alan Turing way back when.
Back in November of 2010.
Yeah. A phenomenal person.
Amazing thinker.
Yeah. One of the, like, the grandfather of computer science. Also, tragic life story, which we went into detail back in that story. And so you might wonder, well, all right, so what does that have to do? What is the guy who was the essentially the father of computer science or grandfather of computer science, what does he have to do with the story about a computer program in June 2014? A computer program with an interesting name, Eugene Goostman, passing the Turing test. What does that all have to do with each other? Well, to answer that, we have to ask, what is a Turing test?
Well, as it turns out, way back in the 1950s, he started envisioning a thought experiment.
Yeah. He published a paper in a journal called Mind in 1950 called Computing Machinery and Intelligence. And he sort of laid out his thought experiment there. And it's interesting because what he did was he took this idea of a party game and then adapted it for computers.
Right. The party game that it's based on would have three participants, an interrogator, a man, and a woman.
Yep.
All situated so that they can't see one another. And the interrogator is supposed to ask questions to try to figure out which of the participants is the dude and which is the lady.
Exactly. And it's the dude's job to try and mislead the interrogator to believe that he, in fact, is the lady and the other one is the man. It's the lady's job to say, hey, I want you to get this right. I'm the lady. That other guy, that's the dude.
Uh-huh.
And so the interrogator has to ask questions. Now, obviously, they can't see each other, because if they could see each other, then that would probably give things away.
Probably.
They really shouldn't be able to hear each other, because that could also give things away.
Sure. And if you use handwritten notes, then the interrogator might be able to make judgments based on the handwriting style. So it should really be typewritten.
Right. So you want to remove as many easily identifiable traits from this game as possible to make it all about the questions and the answers. Now, Turing said, what if we were to take the same basic premise, but instead of having two human interviewees, replace one of those humans with a machine? Now, if that machine can convince the interrogator that the machine itself is a human being, it would be a pretty phenomenal achievement.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, just generally, if the interrogator wasn't sure which of the two interrogatees.
Right. Well, you know, which one's the human? Which one's the machine? Or even if there could be a case where you don't know. It may be that you have two humans that you're interrogating. And it may be one of those things where you have to, you know, if you don't know for a fact that one of them's a machine, that makes it even harder, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least assuming that the computer program is sophisticated enough. Now, Turing was saying that we don't have any machines right now that can do this, but I envision a time when computers will be able to do such a thing, where if you were to interrogate a computer, you would get back responses that would be convincing enough for it to make it difficult to determine if it were man or machine. And so he said that he predicted in 50 years' time, which would be the year 2000, that computers and software would be sophisticated enough that interrogators would only be able to guess correctly 70% of the time.
Meaning that they would be fooled by the computer 30% of the time.
Right. So this was just kind of a thing he was coming up with, like an idea, a prediction, not necessarily a test, although very much like Moore's observation became Moore's law, this became what is known as the Turing test. People talk about the Turing test as a machine capable of fooling people into thinking it's another person at least 30% of the time.
After 5 minutes of conversation.
Very good point. Yes, it needs to be 5 minutes of conversation. If you are just getting maybe two or three responses, that might not be enough for you to be able to draw a conclusion that you feel good about. If after 5 minutes you still are not entirely certain, then that might say that this machine, in fact, has passed the Turing test.
Mm-hmm. And this has been extrapolated to mean something about machine intelligence, because Turing himself tied the idea of how we perceive a machine's intelligence directly to artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and even how we perceive human intelligence.
Sure.
Because here's Turing's idea. It is a little cheeky, and I love the fact that it's so cheeky. So Turing kind of said, would you say such a machine is intelligent? If it appears to be intelligent, is it fair to say that it is intelligent? And Turing said, why not? Because I'm only able to tell that I am intelligent, right? Because of my experience. I'm only able to have my own personal experience. I can't experience what someone else's life is like.
Right. Sitting across from each other, Jonathan and I can only assume that the other one is intelligent.
Right. And it's because the other person is displaying traits that we associate with intelligence. They seem to be able to take in information, respond to it, make decisions. And based on the fact that we ourselves also do that thing, we go ahead and say, all right, well, they clearly have the same features that I have, which includes intelligence. Now, he says, why would we not extend that same courtesy to a machine if it also appeared to display those same features? He says, doesn't matter if the computer is quote unquote thinking.
If it can fool you.
Yeah, if it's able to simulate it well enough, you might as well say it's intelligent. Because
simulate is probably a kinder phrase for that than fool, yes?
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, it is fooling, essentially. I mean, because ultimately, you're talking about a computer programmer mm-hmm. who's making this happen. So nowadays, we think of this as the Turing test. Can a machine, 30% of the time or more, fool someone after 5 minutes of conversation into thinking it's a human? Now, this is really hard to do. This is non-trivial.
I mean, it sounds almost simple.
Yeah. The concept is simple. The execution, incredibly difficult. Because here's the thing. Human language varied. We have unstructured, unpredictable ways to say things. Like, if I were to tell you that it's 100 degrees outside and it is 90% humid, like the humidity is at 90%, and you go out there, then I'm sure all of our listeners would have slightly different ways to express their thoughts on the conditions outside. Some of them would probably contain colorful metaphors.
Probably.
Mine very likely would contain colorful metaphors, particularly if I had to be outside for any length of time. But that's the point. We would all have different ways of saying this. So how do you make a computer program able to interpret all the myriad of ways we could all express the same thought, let alone any thought?
Right. This is what's referred to as natural language recognition, and it's a really huge problem in artificial intelligence.
Yes.
And a lot of other speech-related computer programming.
Exactly. Yeah, this is where a computer program has to be able to parse the language. So it recognizes things like, this word is a noun, this word is a verb, this word alters this other word. And not only does it need to be able to recognize it, it needs to be able to respond in kind, right? So if you had...
appropriately in some way or another, sure.
Yeah, you could have a computer program that's literally making up sentences or, you know, the approximation of a sentence randomly, where it's just pulling strings of words and placing them in a sequence and then presenting them. But that wouldn't be convincing at all. If I were to say, hello, how are you today? And Lauren was to say, Blue Panther pickup jump down street. I'd be like, what? And even that was closer to being a sentence than some of the random stuff that you would see if it was just truly, you know,
completely
jumbled.
Right.
So it also has to be able to endure a 5 minute long conversation, like we said, in order to pass the Turing test. So you can't have too much repetition or that gives it away.
Oh, absolutely. If you've ever been playing a video game and all of the NPCs say the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah. If all the chatbot says is, hey, listen, then you're clearly playing Zelda and you're not actually having a decent conversation. That being said, there is someone I know who plays a fairy at the Georgia Renaissance Festival, and hey, listen is heavily represented in her repertoire.
That's pretty amazing.
No, it's pretty awesome. But at any rate, yeah, so these are big problems. You have to build a database of words. You have to be able to figure out, what kind of syntax are you going for? It's a wide open, huge problem. And solving this problem can be really beneficial in lots of ways. We'll talk a little bit about that later. It's, mm-hmm. it's beyond just making a program that seems human, right? That's one way of looking at it, but there are a lot of other benefits that come along with it, which we'll chat about toward the end of the show.
But for right now, let's go into this story behind Eugene Goostman and whether or not it was actually the first chatbot to pass the Turing test.
Yeah. So first of all, we've got three programmers in this story, Vladimir Veselov, Eugene Demchenko, and Sergei Ulyasin. As you may guess from their names, they all hail from Russia and the Ukraine as well.
Mm-hmm.
And although not all of them still live there, but starting in 2001, they got to work on this, right?
Yeah, they were trying to design a computer program that would pose specifically as a 13-year-old boy from Odessa in the Ukraine.
Yeah, and that meant that they had specific parameters that they could work within. It automatically helped reduce some of that unpredictability and that lack of restriction that you would have if you were to just say, this is a fluent adult speaker of a given language.
Yeah. Giving him these, you know, setting up the expectation from the judges that, you know, this is a non-native English speaker. It's a kid.
Yeah.
Essentially. You know, they'll expect him to have limited knowledge of the world and different subject areas mm-hmm. and a limited understanding of English vocabulary and grammar and
yes.
all of that kind of stuff.
So you're already managing expectations. That's going to come into play when we talk about some of the criticisms about this.
Although I do think it's a very clever way, and a lot of previous chatbots have
had similar, yeah, similar
approaches.
Kind of
yeah.
approaches. Yeah. Because like we said, if you're to take a quote unquote pure approach to this, it's really, really challenging. So yeah, by limiting this, the judges have an idea of, well, this could be a 13-year-old boy or it could be a computer program. It means that the computer program doesn't have to be as sophisticated as one that would be completely fluent and have, an adult's experiences, and ability to communicate. So that was step one. And, Eugene Goostman took part in a competition, that had five total chatbots. It was one of five, that took place on the 60th anniversary of Turing's death. And the program managed to fool 33% of the judges into thinking it was actually a person, and there were 30 judges from what I understand. So that was where you got all the headlines of chatbot or computer beats Turing test, which already is not accurate.
There were some slight hiccups in a little bit of the news reporting,
yeah.
but we'll get into that part of the story later.
Yeah.
But, you know, the key takeaways, I think, here are that this was a competition that was
yep.
celebrating Turing.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yes.
And that there were 30 judges, some of whom were celebrities.
Yes. Including an actor who had appeared on Red Dwarf.
Right. Yes.
Yep. And then a couple of years before that, because you said they started working on this in 2001. This was not the first time that Goostman had entered competition. 2 years previously, that same software had convinced 29% of judges at a similar competition that was held at Bletchley Park. Now, but Bletchley Park, that's where Turing helped crack the Enigma machine, the encoding device that the German military was using during World War II. So this was a big celebration. It was at the centennial celebrating his birth, and it ended up falling just short of passing the Turing test.
At that 29%.
29%, yeah. The organizer of the more recent event, the one in which Goostman ran away with, quote-unquote, beating the Turing test, that organizer was Kevin Warwick. That name may sound familiar to some of our listeners if you've ever heard us talk about cyborgs. He's the guy who had an RFID chip surgically implanted into him.
Mm-hmm.
I believe his wife also did at one point.
Yes, they could communicate with each other through them.
Yeah.
Some unflattering news media sometimes refers to him as Captain Cyborg.
Yeah, there are some critics who say that he courts publicity in a manner that is unbecoming
of a scientist, yes.
Really of anybody. But yes, yes. Those are the critics who say that, by the
yes.
way. I just want to make that clear.
Yes.
At any rate, he said that this was the first time a chatbot had passed the Turing test at an event where the conversation was open-ended, meaning that they had not previously decided upon a specific topic or line of questioning, that the judges were allowed to say whatever they wanted to the chatbot and get responses.
Which obviously makes it harder because you have to have a much wider breadth of
potential responses.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Because again, if you were to say, all right, this chatbot is just going to talk about, I don't know, sporting events from last year, well, then you've
restricted. Can prepare pretty well for that.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So it's one of those, again, it's one of those things where the unrestricted nature adds in a degree of difficulty. It's time for us to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. So why would you need to make the qualification that this is an open-ended approach and this is the first chatbot to have managed it? That would be because, despite what you may have heard, Eugene Guzman was not the first program to beat the Turing test.
Not by a long shot.
So work on these sort of chatbots, these kind of artificial conversationalists, that's real recent, right? I mean, they just started doing that, like what? Like maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Or 2001 at the earliest. I mean, that's when they started with Guzman.
In the 1960s and 70s.
Say what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
back in the mid-1960s, there was Eliza.
Yes.
Which was written by Joseph Weizenbaum.
Yep.
If you're pronouncing it in the correct German.
That is correct. Yeah.
Excellent. I'm finally learning.
I'm sure he pronounces it Weizenbaum, but But no, it would be Weizenbaum.
At any rate.
Yes.
So this was a program that would respond to human conversation in what ideally would be a relevant way.
Yes. It was obviously an early attempt. It was not meant to be a program that takes on the Turing test. It was really a thought, again, kind of like a thought experiment. The idea of what does it take to create a piece of software that can react to questions and make it make sense.
At that point, it was more a can we do this than let's do this for real.
Yeah. And these are the sort of foundations that you have to lay in order for other things like the Eugene Guzman program to be successful.
Yeah.
So he created a language analyzer. Now, this specifically would look at words that users would put in and then compare them against a database of words that were stored in the computer's memory, and then also created scripts. Now, in this case, the scripts were sets of rules. They're kind of like, you know, like a protocol or an algorithm in a way. These rules dictated how Eliza would respond to messages in order to cut down on that huge, massive number of variables we were talking about, that whole unrestricted, unpredictable thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would have different kind of like overlays. Think of them as an overlay that would kind of guide Eliza's responses. And the most well-known one was called Doctor, which put Eliza in the role of a Rogerian psychiatrist. This is the person who responds to everything with a question.
Right. It's that passive interview style.
Yes.
Where you know, you repeat back. You know, if I go, oh man, like I'm really sad about my cat.
Oh, well, tell me, what is it about your cat that makes you sad?
That kind of
thing.
And
then you could say things like, you know, and then it's one of those things like, where as a conversation starts to wind down, you then have another line of questions like, so tell me more about your mother. Like that, the whole tell me about your mother thing, that's really coming back to this kind of model of psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you've ever heard the joke about them responding to anything with another question, someone
just
might
just
say,
taking
like,
the last word and turning it into a question.
Right, like, what am I paying you for? What do you think you're paying me for? That kind of thing. So that's how Eliza responded. And in fact, you can find examples of the Eliza program.
Transcripts.
Transcripts and even the actual, there are ports, you could say. Or people have essentially created their own version of Eliza, just using the original Eliza as a guide. You can find tons of them on the web. And you can attempt to have a conversation with them. It's not terribly compelling, but it's kind of fun. Usually within maybe 4 or 5 exchanges, you've already run into something where you're like, well, this can't be
That's
a person.
Wiggy, yeah.
Or if it's a person, it's the weirdest person I've ever conversed with.
But again, it wasn't really an earnest attempt to create something that would pass the quote-unquote Turing test.
Right.
Which I don't think was being referred to as such at that point yet.
Yeah, it was kind of a, I mean, people knew about Turing's prediction, but it wasn't so much called a Turing test.
Yes.
But another chatbot that premiered in the early 1970s went even further and actually was an attempt to try and pass the Turing test in a very specific approach. Kind of like, you know, Eugene Goosman is a very specific approach to narrow down that those parameters. In this case, this one was called Parry, P-A-R-R-Y.
Right. And Kenneth Colby created it to emulate a patient who has paranoid schizophrenia.
Yeah. Someone who has, you know, sort of a persecution complex. They imagine that there are, people or other entities that are out to get them. And in this, specific case, he kind of really embraced this approach. It reminds me of people who create a, like a Dungeons and Dragons character, but then give their character an entire backstory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This Parry persona was an entire persona. It was a 28-year-old man with a job as a post office clerk who was single, had no brothers and sisters, and rarely saw his parents. He had specific hobbies.
He liked to go to the movies and...
horse racing.
Yeah, he liked to bet on the horses.
Yeah. He had placed a bet with bookies in the past.
Right, and that... He realized later bookies have an association with the criminal underworld and that therefore the mafia knew about him and were out to get him.
Yeah.
Now all of that might sound very ridiculous to you. If you never had any kind of interaction with someone who suffers from paranoid schizophrenia, that can seem like, well, that seems cartoonish. But no, this kind of thinking is not uncommon.
Sure.
You know, whether it's a criminal organization or the government, or some other even unnamed entity?
Oh, absolutely. It's very much realistic in terms of that kind of diagnosis. And if I was speaking about it with humor in my voice a moment ago, it's only because I am absolutely tickled that the programmers of this program
built it in. Yeah, no, like I mean, that. It's actually pretty entertaining that they went so far as to make this whole backstory to explain it, because that's what gives it the believability, right? And then they ended up testing it. In conversation with a human, Parry would gradually start to introduce his thoughts, quote unquote, thoughts about being persecuted, and would respond sensitively to anything said about his appearance, family, or religious beliefs. I've actually seen lots of transcripts of conversations with Parry. And sure enough, it's one of those things where, you know, you might have a few exchanges and then Parry ends up saying something that seems really odd, but not so odd as to seem artificial. It just seems like it's a non sequitur.
Right.
You know, something like, well, that's what they want you to think. And if you were to say, who are they? Like, the mafia. Who did you think I was talking about? Like, the mafia are after you? So, of course they're after me. They know who I am. That kind of stuff. And it's disturbing. Like, it's, you know, when you know what it is, it's kind of amusing. But like, if you're in the middle of a conversation,
you're like, oh,
this poor person. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, in order to test it, Colby did a couple different things. He did one test where 8 psychiatrists interviewed both Parry and a human patient via teletypewriter. So in both cases, the psychiatrist could not see who they were interviewing. This is going back to the original Turing test idea,
mm-hmm.
or at least Turing's proposed experiment. And in this case, only 2 out of the 8 were able to identify that one of the interviewees was human and the other was a machine. In a second test, Colby presented a group of 100 psychiatrists, almost said psychics, transcripts of interviews between Parry and...
That would change the game.
Yeah. Yeah, he had pairs of... exactly. I foresee... No, but they gave these psychiatrists transcripts of interviews between an interviewer and Parry and an interviewer and a human patient. And 40 out of the 100 responded. I don't know if the other 60 just never got it or if they didn't...
Yeah, response rates are variable. Yeah.
Right. So out of the 40 who responded, 19 of them guessed incorrectly. So that's almost a 50%. That's,
yeah.
You know, getting, you know, right up there with a pretty impressive amount. Now, again, we have to look at the fact that Parry is operating under a very restricted set of rules. We're talking about a paranoid schizophrenic, someone who we would assume would occasionally
have non-normative answers
exactly
to conversational pieces.
Right.
Yes.
And again, it's a limited time that you're having with this person or this entity in this case, this program. And, because the psychiatrists had a specific expectation of the type of interactions they were going to see that could have affected their answer, mm-hmm. right? So ideally, in the perfect situation, you would have this interview happening where you have no expectation as to what the answers should be. In other words, you don't know ahead of time that the interviewee is having any kind of other, you know, any kind of restrictions upon that person, so that you would be interviewing anyone, like any average person. But that's obviously not what we're talking about here, nor was it the one for Eugene Guzman.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've also seen, by the way, transcripts of people who set up Eliza and Perry to talk to each other.
Oh no.
So you have Eliza acting as the Rogerian psychiatrist and Perry, the paranoid schizophrenic, having bizarre conversations, and they usually don't last very long because Perry gets upset. And obviously, by gets upset, I just mean that Perry ends up essentially shutting down the conversation because Eliza just wants to ask questions and Perry gets suspicious of people who are asking questions. And by, again, get suspicious, I'm saying following specific rules that make it feel like this computer program is getting suspicious.
Right.
But they are entertaining. If you ever do a search online, just look for Eliza Perry transcripts. There are a few of them, and they're all pretty entertaining.
But so since that time, I mean, obviously, lots and lots of chatbots have been created.
Yeah, for multiple reasons.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, some of them are trying to test the Turing test,
yep.
and others are trying to fool you into giving out your credit card information
or
on
clicking
the internet.
On a link that has malicious links to malicious software. Yeah. Anyone who's been on any kind of chat program, specifically like AIM, mm-hmm. has probably encountered this at least once or twice where they're getting an unsolicited message from someone
or something.
Yeah. And if you type a couple times, you realize, oh, this is not actually
a real person.
This is an attempt to either get information from me or have me click on a link. Yeah, that's a thing. But there are some examples of, I guess saying legitimate is weird, but there are some examples of other
More scholarly attempts.
Yeah, like a PC therapist.
Yeah. That one was by Joseph Weintraub.
Yep, back in 1991.
Mm-hmm, and it fooled 50% of its judges into thinking that it was human.
Yep.
50% of 10 judges,
yeah.
of course. So
if I'm doing my math correctly, that's 5.
That I believe you are, unless we're talking about quantum judges.
That's true. These judges were both right and wrong at the same time.
and it was... It was a whimsical program, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it had some, I think it's fair to say its answers could be pretty smartass. also, I read some of these transcripts and it actually surprised me that enough judges thought that it was a person. Maybe they thought it was a person who was purposefully attempting to fool them into thinking it was a computer.
Huh.
You know, because it would say things like, I compute, therefore I am, that kind of stuff. Where it was specifically making these sort of statements.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at this stuff and you're thinking, all right, well, maybe this is kind of going back to that original Turing test party game where mm-hmm. the effort is for a person, like the person who's being interviewed is trying to throw everybody off. And that's perfectly within the rules unless you state up front, no, just be honest in your answers. There's nothing in here, by the way, that says that the interviewee has to tell the truth necessarily unless you just state that as a parameter at the beginning.
Right.
So in other words, you could be like, I'm totally the computer and you're the human being interviewed. I don't know if that's a fair way of saying that the device won or lost, but it is a possibility. Then we have 2011. Now this one's a really pretty impressive one. And this was Cleverbot, which was made by a fellow named Rollo Carpenter, and it fooled 59.3% of a live audience at an event in India.
With more than 1,000 people.
Yeah. The way this worked was that the audience watched as interviewers interacted via text with either Cleverbot or a human in the course of a 4-minute interview. So it's a little shorter than what Turing had said, but not by a whole lot.
Uh-huh.
I mean, 4 minutes is still a good amount of time.
Sure. That is 20% less.
That's true. That's true. So keep that in mind.
But
at any rate, it was a pretty interesting experience. It also, from what I read, they misidentified. They thought that the human was a computer 63% of the time, because they didn't necessarily just say that it was a computer or it was a Cleverbot. So now we see that there are a few examples of chatbots, quote unquote, passing the Turing test. So what does that mean? Does it mean that the machines are actually thinking?
No.
Oh, bummer.
I mean, and it's not to say that computers don't have a certain amount of machine intelligence, but there's absolutely a distinction between that and what we consider to be human intelligence.
That's true. The programmers themselves have said that this doesn't mean a machine is able to think. They're just able to interpret commands and then follow a set of rules to make
right,
a response.
Right. Which is still pretty cool. And it doesn't. It certainly doesn't mean that the Turing test is worthless as an exercise.
No, it is. In fact, it's improving our ability to create programs that can understand or at least respond to natural language. Natural language recognition is one of those big things where if you're really able to crack it, then you can have some amazing opportunities open up. And we've seen this recently with stuff like Siri.
Oh, absolutely. Being able to speak to your computer rather than having to... I mean, even if you could speak to your computer through a keyboard and have it understand what you're saying, I mean, like, it's the reason why Google spends so much time and money in its search algorithms of trying to figure out what you really mean when you search for a certain phrase.
Right. Because traditionally, you know, before we really got into the natural language recognition era, it meant that in order to work with a computer, you had to work with a computer on the computer's terms. You had to learn the commands. You had to learn the way to navigate a computer system in order for it to do what you wanted it to do.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to a point where natural language recognition software is robust enough, the computer is working on your terms.
Right.
You can put in however you're thinking, whatever mental exercise you've gone through to ask this computer to do something. Whatever you do to kind of express a thought as a command to this computer, the computer can then interpret and then respond.
And it's not just for serving you back whatever information you happen to be looking for. I mean, we're talking about being able to just look at a computer and say, you know, I really want a graph that looks blue and has these percentages in it and is about this thing. And
right.
Just does it.
Yeah. Like I want to see what the population distribution of Atlanta is in a bar chart or something. And then it could bring that up.
It goes out, finds that information, puts it into a bar chart. And
yeah, it's pretty phenomenal stuff.
We have a little bit more to say about passing the Turing test. But before we get to that, let's take another quick break.
We see other examples of machine intelligence everywhere, things like pattern recognition, probabilistic predictions. For example, Pandora, you know, the music genome project.
That's pattern recognition.
Yeah, it's looking for elements of songs that you say you like and then looking for other stuff that's not in the specific category you mentioned or the specific examples you mentioned and saying,
and pulling
here's
them
something
in.
Else you probably will like because you like these other things that also have this stuff in it.
Sure. You know, sometimes that's less functional than other times.
Yeah. It makes me think of Patton Oswalt has a great routine about TiVo that does the same sort of thing where he says, you know, TiVo's great. I mean, I love Westerns and I'll have it set to TiVo a Western for me. And I come back and then there'll be all these other Westerns that'll be suggested that I didn't even know about. And I think, thank you, TiVo. But then sometimes TiVo gets it wrong and I come back and everything has got horses in it. Because Westerns have horses in it. So I've got My Little Pony and cartoons with horses and unicorns and things. And I have to say, no, TiVo, that's a bad TiVo. But TiVo says, but you said you liked horses.
Yeah.
Same sort of thing. Like when you get more sophisticated, then the computer program starts to anticipate things and makes these probabilistic models, these models where there are certain percentages associated with various responses and it goes with whichever one seems to be the most prevalent, assuming it meets a threshold. If this sounds familiar to you, it's because that's how IBM's Watson worked.
Oh, right. Right. Which is a really good example of natural language recognition.
Absolutely. Because not only was it able to recognize natural language, it had to interpret things like wordplay.
Oh, yeah.
That's Jeopardy. Dude, this is the machine that went on Jeopardy and beat the returning champions, or former champions. And, you know, if you've ever played Jeopardy or watched Jeopardy, you know that there are categories that depend on things like puns or homonyms or other forms of wordplay So it has to parse all of that. And that's even more complicated than just taking a simple sentence and figuring out, all right, what are the potential responses to whatever this phrase is. So great example. You know, it would end up coming up with a potential answer. It would assign a percentage of how quote unquote sure it was that that was the right answer. And if the percentage was higher than its threshold, which I think was 80%, something like that, it would buzz in and give that as a guess. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was wrong, but it was right a lot of the time. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So getting back to Eugene.
Right.
Gene the Mean Machine, as I called him in my notes at one point. And of course I'm anthropomorphizing when I say him. It's an it.
Well, it has a dude name.
Yeah, it has a dude name and a dude persona.
Yes.
But it ultimately is an it. Would you say that perhaps some of the reporting around this was maybe a little misleading or at least hype-ish?
Well, the entire Eugene Goosman chatbot sounds really cool. I haven't met it personally.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. Although you can.
There is an internet version, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that it's the same version that's being used in competition because I've seen some transcripts from the internet version and they don't seem good.
Yeah.
At all. They seem bad.
Right. I guess you'd have to talk to some actual 13-year-old boys from Odessa.
Actually, yeah. This is part of it. There's certainly been some questions among natural language AI enthusiasts online about whether we're really just lowering our expectations for human communication.
Which, yeah, that's a totally different way of looking at and a depressing one.
Right.
To say that, oh, well, if you come from this place and if you are of this age, then I expect you to only be able to communicate at this level.
Right. Which is depressing.
So, it's insulting a little bit.
It
too.
Certainly is. Well, but it's a valid point, I think. I think it's a good thing to be thinking about in this kind of situation. Beyond that though, and I certainly don't want to downplay the, apparent achievements of its programmers,
sure.
because I haven't programmed any capable chatbots today.
No, it's been ever since I did.
But there are a few things that are just a little bit shady about the news. First off, the original press release, which came out of the University of Reading.
Yes, I believe so.
Stated that a, quote, supercomputer had achieved this feat. And perhaps, charitably, it was a mistake or misunderstanding on the part of the writer of the press release, but some skeptics have suggested that it was, in fact, a purposeful publicity play that, in fact, worked because a whole lot of news headlines around the interwebs repeated the error very excitedly.
Yes, because it was not a supercomputer. It was a computer running a piece of software.
It's a program.
Yes, yeah. The program that did the work. I mean, the computer just provided the horsepower.
Right.
Right? It's the software that did all the actual work. And it was not a supercomputer.
It wasn't on a supercomputer.
No. This little known fact. Supercomputers have better things to do than run chatbot software.
Generally.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about things like figuring out global weather change patterns and things like that, you know, or the way that money works. Chatbots.
Low on their priority list.
It's like number 7.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. And also this press release in question was largely a quotation from Dr. Kevin Warwick. Kevin Warwick, of course, being the fellow who organized this entire competition.
Right.
Who's an engineer and a futurist, and also the instigator and or enjoyer of a certain amount of hype and debate about future technologies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he is obviously, you can tell, I mean, this is the guy who elected to have surgery performed on him so he could have, that RFID chip.
And call himself a cyborg.
This is someone who not only embraces these ideas of futurism, but is actively trying to promote them and get to them. That we're not even saying that that's a bad thing. What we are saying is that that may give him somewhat of a bias when it comes to proclaiming a piece of computer software being an amazing achievement that beat the Turing test.
Oh, right. Sure. I mean, he admits basically to being a provocateur. He says that that's really his job, you know, is to get people excited about tech and engineering and the future. And we get that. Like yeah. that's,
we agree
that's
with
our
that.
Job too. We think it's rad.
We think that perhaps, I don't want to put words into your mouth, Lauren. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps that there's a different way of going about it where you can still be excited, but you can be a little more grounded in the way you present things. Because I also think the achievement of creating a chatbot that could be convincing is a fantastic achievement. I mean, it's something that
even under any number of qualifications,
incredibly challenging to do, no matter how you frame it. I do think, however, that if you seem to overinflate the achievement, you run the danger of making people feel jaded about it later.
Yeah, which you don't want to cry computer wolf.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So it's one of those things where, you have to take the context into account.
Right. Right.
And don't downplay the achievement, but yeah. Don't sit there and say like, aha, now we have intelligent computers everywhere. That's not true either. I saw, there's a great Wired article that specifically went into, kind of debunking the whole beating the Turing test thing.
Right.
And again, kind of saying the same thing we're saying, like take the context into account. And in part of that article, they ended up asking a cognitive scientist named Gary Marcus of NYU about this. And Marcus proposed a new version of the Turing test because he says the old version's not really a measurement of machine intelligence. It does kind of illustrate ways of creating natural language recognition and clever ways to fool the human side.
Uh-huh. And that it was very valid historically at the time because, textual communication was new and exciting.
And it was, it pushed the field forward. It really did. But now we've gotten to a point where fooling the person on the other side of a keyboard is not necessarily the goal that we should be looking at. He proposes the next version of the Turing test should be that a computer software, like any kind of program that wants to beat it, what it has to do is first, quote unquote, watch a movie, television show, YouTube video, something.
Some kind of video media, yeah.
And then be able to respond to questions about it. So sort of like, here, let me show you this 10-minute video on car safety and then asking questions about specifically about the video. What happened after they fastened the seatbelt? That kind of thing.
Huh. Uh-huh.
And if the computer program's able to answer it, then that would be a much more convincing Turing test than just kind of spewing out a script.
Sure.
Which is, it's adding another layer of difficulty on top of an already difficult task, but that's the whole only way you can go forward. Otherwise, we're just going to see increasingly sophisticated chatbots. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is actually a very difficult and interesting problem. Wasn't it just recently that there was a computer that we taught, I mean, not us personally, but that humanity, some researchers somewhere taught to identify cats?
Yes.
Based on
that was
pictures of cats?
Yeah, that was the AI program that essentially went through thousands and thousands of, I think it was images and videos, and then became able to identify cats. It essentially defined what a cat was because no one taught it.
Right. It learned what cats are.
Yeah, based upon their appearance.
On their appearance and can look at pictures of cats and say that is totally a cat.
Yeah, essentially saying that thing that is in that video is the same as this other thing that's in this picture, that's the same as this other thing that's in this totally different video.
Which sounds trivial and hilarious, and it kind of is hilarious.
Also easy, because, I mean, come on, everything on the internet has cats in it.
Yeah, that is kind of a gimme, isn't it?
But still, no, it is cool.
I mean, because just that level of image recognition, I mean, being able to take an object and look at it from a different angle than you were taught,
right.
or that's a different color,
that's a different size. Yeah. Yeah. All of these things are easy for us, hard for computers. So seeing something make that breakthrough is really exciting. Anyway, we thought we would take that story and kind of break it down for you guys, explain how it's still cool, but maybe not as cool as the way some of the headlines are saying.
Right. And also say, hey, internet journalists, step up your game.
Yeah. I understand that you want people to read your stuff.
Oh, yeah. And you're under deadline pressure, and that's terrible.
But
let's
represent reality,
yeah.
Shall we?
don't just spit out press releases the way that you found them.
Yeah. And I would be criminal to neglect to mention Noel. Our producer reminded me that obviously this is a very important field of study because we want to be able to tell the difference between computers and humans when the future of Blade Runner becomes our reality and you're chasing down a replicant and you have to determine if it's actually a replicant or a human being.
And that wraps up this classic episode about passing the Turing test. Honestly, the whole Turing test thing, that general concept has morphed over the decades. And it's more like shorthand, right? Passing the Turing test isn't so much about passing a specific hypothetical test. It's more about this idea of creating a machine that appears to be indistinguishable from a human as far as, you know, processing and communicating information so that you feel like the machine is truly intelligent. I think the Turing test is one of those concepts that changes over time, and it's more like you start to find out what it's not rather than what it is. It's an interesting thing. It's very much like artificial intelligence itself or even machine consciousness. These are all concepts that are kind of wibbly-wobbly, as Doctor Who might say. Well, if you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, reach out to me. The best way to do that is over on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.